Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
the guy that's too boring to come up with a neat thing today. I'm Corey Knockreiner.
Oh, of course, Corey Knockreiner. And on today's episode, we have a special edition where we go over our Q3 2018 Internet Security Report that was just released a few days ago now.
Sounds deeply fascinating.
Yeah, we're assuming that you haven't had time to read all 30-whatever pages of
it. What are you talking about? I'm sure all of them jumped on it the second we published it. Who doesn't want to read 38 pages of security research?
So for those that want it in audio form instead, listen to this podcast. And with that, we'll jump right in. In today's episode, we are going to talk about the just-released WatchGuard Quarterly Internet Security Report for Q3 of 2018. Hooray!
Because we know all about the interwebs.
Yes. And I mean, I don't know why we have to cover this. I know by now all of our listeners have read all 38 pages of the report.
Yeah, front it's only back, been right? out about a day or two. They must have read it by now.
Yeah, exactly. But just in case there are some of you out there that have not gone through the report in its entirety yet.
Or even glanced at the short and easy to consume infographic.
Yes. We will go ahead and dive into some of the key takeaways from it and some of the interesting trends that we wrote about, while still leaving you a bit left on the plate to go and nibble on once you actually download the full report. So if you're not familiar with the Quarterly Internet Security Report.
The Quarternet.
That's what we should call it from now on. In today's Quarternet episode, we usually break the report down into a few main sections. We start with something called the Firebox feed, which is threat intelligence that we gather from our Firebox network security appliances deployed throughout the world. We go over malware trends and network attack trends.
Jeez. Sorry, Mark. My words are so good today. And network attracts.
I have the best words
Network attracts are a new term for phishing and social engineering. They're network attract methods.
Kill me now. Outside of malware and network attacks, we also talk about one or two of the top internet security incidents from the previous quarter. And then we go into our threat research section where our threat lab talks about whatever research projects we've been working on for the last quarter. So with that said, I guess we can dive into the first bit, which is the Firebox feed section.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! At a high level, this quarter we set another record for the number of Fireboxes we had reporting in. A hair over 40,000, I think, this time, which, as we point out, is still only a fraction of the appliances that we have deployed out there throughout the world.
Yeah, I'd say it's a little more than 10% at this point, but it's not much more than 11 or 12%.
And if you are a WatchGuard customer and you want to help us feed this report with more interesting data so we can have the most accurate trends, there's a little checkbox under the general settings in whichever method you use to manage your Firebox. If you check the checkbox, it says send device feedback to WatchGuard. We will get this threat intelligence, which we can add to the report and make it more accurate. From those 40,000 or so Fireboxes deployed throughout the world, we had just over 14 million hits from Gateway Antivirus, which is
just one of three now.
Yeah, it's our signature-based traditional network antivirus. And that's a 34% increase from last quarter, which is interesting, but a 36% decrease from year over year.
Yep.
This year has actually been a bit of a lull when it comes to malware.
And we'll talk about it later, network attacks as well.
Yeah. One of our other anti-malware services we provide, APT Blocker, which is a sandbox-based behavioral detection engine. That one had 3.5 million hits, which was a 31% increase quarter over quarter. And actually a 14% increase year over year. So even if signature-based malware is down, this zero-day malware, as we call it, or malware that we detect using behaviors instead of signatures is still up year over year.
Although interestingly, the stuff we're catching with APT Blocker is up quarter over quarter, but I think it actually still had a low zero-day number, which we'll talk about, simply because malware was significantly, the Gateway Antivirus caught significantly more than usual in that particular ratio.
Yeah. Every quarter, we include this number that we call the zero-day malware number, which is just a percentage that we tie to the amount of malware that we detect using sandboxed behavioral-based detection as opposed to signature-based detection. And really, this number is just a means of showing how much malware you are missing if you rely only on signature-based detections. And this quarter, 28.9% of all the malware we detected was zero-day malware, which is lower than we've seen in previous quarters. Quarter two was 37.4%, but it's still over a quarter of all malware.
Yeah, I mean, if you're missing, what is that, one in three, or almost one in three, at the very least one in four of every threat, your business is probably in deep crap. By the way, a little diversion while we're talking about this. During this quarter, we also released a new anti-malware service. You might have heard me say three. We have something called Intelligent AV, and it's a layer kind of between our gateway antivirus and APT blocker as far as how we process through different layers of anti-malware. And it's really based on machine learning and artificial intelligence and huge volumes of known good files and known malware to train it. And really, it's a much more proactive way to also catch zero-day malware, kind of the same way APT blocker does. The difference being the machine learning models built into the engine, so it makes a decision immediately, kind of like gateway antivirus. So it has the speed benefits of signature-based anti-malware without the downside of missing new malware, which seems to be the bulk of malware you see every single day. So we actually do have seen some preliminary results of that. We didn't include it in this report because we actually didn't have a full quarter of having that service. You might, though, see us change the zero-day malware and even our Firebox malware section a bit, either in the upcoming quarter or the quarter after. It really depends on, you know, whether or not you have this service depends on if you've gotten the latest firmware update. So we might wait until we have enough participating boxes. But expect some new stats in either the Q4 or Q1 report coming up that has Intelligent AV results as well.
Yep. Last high-level stat, just quarter over quarter, malware in general rose by 23%. And this follows a trend that we have seen for the last few years where there's a big peak in quarter four of the previous year, drops down at the beginning of the year, and then slowly rises back up through quarter four and then repeats. This trend hasn't really been broken, and I assume that it's something we're going to continue to see.
Yeah, we expect it. And if you haven't read our previous reports, our theory on this is really around the holiday season. There's a lot heavier shopping. We've already kind of passed the season for Cyber Monday and Black Friday. Mm-hmm. Said those backwards, but you know what I mean. Anyways, during that season of a lot of shopping deals, more than the normal retail emails, it's a good opportunity for spear phishing or phishing campaigns that might have malware attached to them. So it's very likely the holiday season accounts for that Q4 bump we have seen every year so far.
Yep. So as exciting as high-level stats are, the real interesting...
Is that all they want to know? Just raw numbers?
Yeah, exactly.
Who cares about what the malware does?
The real interesting stuff is when we actually dive into the top 10 malware samples that we detected over the quarter. And we saw a few new ones, quite a few repeats in this last quarter. The first one I want to bring up, though, is something that is new to this quarter, and that is we had our first macOS malware crack the top 10 list. It actually came in at number 6. It was a form of scareware, similar to the fake alert malware that you may have heard us talk about or seen in previous reports, but specifically targeting macOS appliances or macOS software. Some interesting facts about this one. It was actually signed with a valid Apple-issued certificate, which means it gets around some of the protections from, like, Gatekeeper, which is macOS's security agent, I guess.
I think they kind of call it a firewall, but I think it mixes AV in there. It actually has hashes for a lot of known mm-hmm. threats, so it's kind of a light form of AV. I think Gatekeeper is also what they use to, whenever you run new programs, they technically call... you know, Gatekeeper part of whether or not you allow that new program to run if it wasn't signed
yep.
by Apple.
You've probably encountered Gatekeeper before if you've downloaded any application from the internet on your Mac. Before
especially
you can
one that
on
Apple
internet.
Doesn't really know about. Yeah. Kind of an indie application yep. versus one that's on the store.
You usually have to jump through a few extra hoops in order to run that application after downloading it. So seeing a macOS malware in the top 10 list is interesting because I was under the impression that Macs don't get malware.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, this is fake news, right? This cannot be right. I mean, I'm a longtime Mac user and they're perfectly secure.
Exactly. I mean, you and I, we joke, but you and I have known for quite some time that Macs are not just inherently immune to malware.
Let's do another diversion, though, because I do want to, like, you and I will be talking about a takeaway is you need to secure your Mac. It's not any better than the average OS, I would say, to malware. But I do want to kind of be fair to talk about history. You know, there are things that we're not knocking Apple security. Apple actually has a decent security team. I did it, too. I should not throw stones. Karma is coming back hard.
Glass houses, yo.
I know all the best words. Anyways, they actually have a really good security team, and I want to give them fair credit for like design choices. Like over a decade ago, they've had a strong separation between, you know, what Linux nerds like us call the super user or the true administrative or system account. And even, let's say your named account has administrative privileges. And what I mean by that is you might log on to your Mac as an admin user. There's still going to be more login requests whenever you do something using that super user privilege. And that's something Apple has done for a long time. Linux has done since really the start of time, as far as I'm concerned. But something Windows was behind on. They have it now. What do they call it? UAC, I think, is what you see pop up now. But Windows was the one for the longest time where if you log in with the admin user, that user is, you know, you can admin, you can run everything with the full system
computer
privilege.
God.
Exactly. Whereas even if you're an admin user on a Mac, for some tasks, it still requires a secondary login. And why is that important? Well, if a hacker used like some memory exploit to get control of a process, there might be some limits to what that attacker could do. So they do things like that. They're also really good at secure boot. They've done it on their phones and on their OS for the longest time. Again, something Windows has caught up with, but by secure boot, the hardware has, you know, its own unique certificates. The entire boot process and what OS loads is kind of protected by that certificate. Something, again, that Windows is catching up with, but I got to give credit, Mac's done it before. Mm-hmm. And even gatekeeper to some sense, I feel like Mac's philosophy is the user shouldn't have to think about security. So gatekeeper is their attempt at trying to do security software. So as we start talking about how Macs are not like invulnerable, don't get me wrong, Macs have made decent secure design choices. But what it really comes down to is if you look at Apple alerts, security alerts every month, their Mac OS has a long list of, you know, anywhere from 30 to 60 code execution level vulnerabilities. So no matter how good they are at making decent secure design choices, ultimately, you can install malware on them in the same types of ways you can install malware on Windows systems. Sure, there are security controls you need to evade, but those same type of controls are now on Windows systems too.
And part of the reason I think why previously there was always that theory that Mac didn't get malware, or at least that whatever you want to call it, was because attackers didn't really target Mac OS a whole lot.
Yeah, it's all about market share, right? I mean, as security people, we hate security by obscurity because we know it's not true security. But there is some level of truth to the fact that, you know, 10 years ago, if less than 1% of users used Mac, and a bad guy already knows how to make Windows malware, and he knows that 95% of his targets are going to be Windows anyways, why even bother learning to attack Mac? So market changes have happened. MacBooks are really popular nowadays. I mentioned that you see a lot more engineers, traditional even Linux engineers, starting to use them. BSD Core is my theory.
I wonder how much it has to do with the architecture, too, because previously Macs were PowerPC based, right?
Well, that's why, to me, Mac OS 10, now Mac OS, is what changed it. That's when they went to that BSD Core. It essentially is like any Linux or Unix system if you go to terminal. So engineers can be very comfortable with it. The other benefit from going from PowerPC, like you say, is the Intel, you know, no big Indian, little Indian types of things engineers would have to figure out. So it's much easier for an Intel-based Linux preferring engineer to use Macs nowadays in the same way they do.
Yeah.
So anyways, they're way more popular. And the point is, no, they weren't invulnerable before. They just weren't targeted because there's no money in it, no return in investment to the criminals. That is changing. You know, Mac was the first, what is it, $1 trillion company? Yeah. Although Microsoft just followed, right?
Yeah.
But so obviously there's money in Macs today. So things are changing, guys.
Very much so. Another interesting malware hit we saw was a old code injector called Razy.
Razy. You say tomato, I say tomato.
Exactly. Either way, it was an old code injector that just this last quarter, at least in our detections, added cryptocurrency mining. And this is following one of our, I guess not predictions, one that didn't make the cut, but a prediction that Trojans are going to start adding cryptocurrency modules.
By the way, we've been talking about it for a long time. I think we both know crypto miners are increasing, and why we never made it a prediction is because we feel like it already has happened and we've known about it for a while. But yeah, it's definitely following, you know, what we've told you in the past two internet security reports. In Q1 this year, we warned you that they're starting to ramp up, so expect them in the top 10. Last quarter, they came in the top 10, and this quarter, they're remaining there.
Yep. And even though this is still going in the face of the fact that the cryptocurrency markets are currently, the bubble is bursting. They're in relative free fall. But even then, it's just such an easy little module to add that might earn a few more pennies.
That is my prediction, though, is I think we, between last quarter and this quarter, this might be the plateau. Mm-hmm. Not that crypto mining will go away or that we won't still see one or two variants of it in the top 10. But I don't think it will continue to grow as quickly until cryptocurrency recovers some value. But like you say, once you have, like Razy, we call it a code injector, and that's in part because it can actually inject processes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it really is kind of a backdoor Trojan slash botnet. So it can have lots of modular payloads. And as you said, once you have a crypto miner as a payload, even if cryptocurrency is going down in value, it's kind of like a no-brainer. You turn on that miner anyways just to generate whatever revenue you can. In the back. If it's someone else's machine, who gives a damn, right? If you're an attacker.
Exactly. The last big malware thing I wanted to hit, I don't know if you have any others, was an oldie but a goodie that stuck around for a bit, and that's Mimikatz, which remained number one in the top 10 list by quite some margin, actually.
Woo-hoo.
In fact, it had more than twice the number of hits as the number two detected threat we saw. I feel like we've talked about Mimikatz a bajillion times on this podcast.
In case you don't know, it's a credential or password stealer, so multi-factor is the way to go. My one question here is, I wonder how much attribute, the thing with Mimikatz is it can go both ways, meaning it is absolutely a tool that bad guys use. In fact, they use the off-the-shelf version of Mimikatz themselves, but it is very much also a penetration tester tool that I would suspect security practitioners use a lot. IT guys with a security knowledge that do vulnerability assessment might do it too. So it's hard to say, you know, whether all of the Mimikatz we see is totally malicious use or just people downloading it. Granted, one security professional at a company only downloads it once, not a million times. So
yeah.
It is kind of suspicious.
The fact that it's number one by such a high margin means there has to be some sort of automated attack going on with it.
Yeah.
Unless there's a very prolific pen tester out there somewhere that's just hammering away at boxes.
So, by the way, I'm sure we're going to be talking about, like, at the end of our whole report, practical takeaways.
Yep.
But should we just start really with three quick tips for the malware section?
Sure. And I think the first one's easy, and you kind of hit on it, which is macOS is not invulnerable, which means you really do need endpoint security of some kind, or at least some anti-malware security protecting your Mac computers.
Exactly. There's security suites now that combine better firewalls with the existing Apple one, and more importantly, have malware protection. You know, you have a firebox. The reason this isn't our number one threat is if you do have a firebox when your Mac is behind your corporate network, sure, we can protect you. But I'm willing to bet at least half your Macs leave the building and travel. So for any Mac that leaves the corporate network, definitely make sure it has a security suite. Now that you've given that tip, I guess for Razy, if we're talking about crypto mining capabilities, you know, I stole a tip from you that I really like. In the report we mentioned, by the way, while some crypto miners are better than others at hiding their activity, One of the ones we analyzed in this report actually didn't hide at all and immediately spiked our CPU to 98%. So one tip is if your computer ever gets slow, you know, it could be assigned to crypto mining, open up process or task manager to look at processes and maybe kill that. But another tip, besides having our products to prevent the crypto miners in the first place that you shared that I kind of like, this is more along the lines of web-based crypto miners, is NoCoin. So there's browser extension. Some of the crypto miners we're seeing in the wild, rather than being part of a Trojan like Razzie was, they actually, you know, just when you go to a certain site, they'll start mining from your computer in the background. And I really do like the way that NoCoin's pretty good at detecting and blocking that whenever it happens.
Yeah, I agree. Any other tips you wanted to go, or should we go on to regional stats?
Well, the last tip for Mimikatz is just multi-factor authentication. Yes. You know, Mimikatz is all about stealing credentials. Hopefully you use really strong passwords, and even if bad guys got your hashes, they wouldn't be able to crack them. But just in case, multi-factor is the best way so that you don't only rely on the password as the only factor of authentication.
And I'll also pitch password managers again, too. Because having a strong, unique password for each account can help limit the fallout if one of your accounts becomes compromised. Of course, multi-factor helps a heck of a lot, too.
What, I should have different passwords?
So
dragon on all my accounts isn't a good idea? But I like dragons, Mark.
I thought it was Hunter 2. regional stats? We actually had a really interesting quarter when it came to the overall breakdown of malware. Historically, we've had America and Europe fighting over the top spot, but this quarter we had APAC, so Asia Pacific, come in with 46%, or just about 46% of all of our malware detected, number one, followed by Europe at 32% or so, and America at 23% or so, which is an interesting trend. We've been seeing APAC kind of creep up. It was historically in last place. The last few quarters, it's come up into like second, but it's number one now.
Yeah. And this is very interesting, by the way, a little inside baseball for you guys. But, you know, because this is all based on the Firebox feed, which is this threat intel we get from appliances, you know, where we get data partially is affected by where we sell the most. And we sell in the European region, the Asian Pacific region, and the Americas. But I will say that there's many more boxes by the numbers in America and Europe. So not only is APAC's malware going up noteworthy based on past historical reports, but it's also going up against the ratio of the amount of boxes we get data from in APAC. So it's a really large rise.
Yep.
Now, the bad thing is, I mean, obviously, we would love to know why this is happening and include it in the report. I will say the one malware variant we didn't cover that's probably responsible for a huge amount of the malware growth in APAC is a signature called Win32 HURE, and the HURE stands for heuristics. And a heuristic signature basically looks for common, you know, heuristics are just things that a file might do on a computer, a process or a file, where it might live on the computer, where it runs from, because maybe things running out of one directory is normal, but another directory is not normal, whether it makes some connections to the outside world. Just we look at these different heuristic things and we add them all up to see, is this a suspicious file that's malware? The long story short, the reason I bring all this up is when we're trying to figure out what campaign or what malware instance is really causing this uprise in APAC, you know, we would want to look at what signature it's hitting. And unfortunately, this heuristic signature is very generic. It could equally catch ransomware as well as it could catch a piece of fake AV. You know, by its very nature, it's a generic detection mechanism that can catch all kinds of different malware samples. So we're not really seeing any one specific variant that's blowing up in APAC. We can look at the hashes, by the way, and look at individual files. But for this signature, there's just so many of them that it's hard to find any big trends.
When it comes to individual threats, though, we do have some stats for some ones we covered. Razzie, or whatever you want to call it, did actually primarily hit APAC.
Yep.
91% of all of our detections for Razzie were in APAC. and I think it was India and Thailand, country-wise, that had the most hits for that. The Mac malware we saw, Mac OS X AM Cleaner, was pretty evenly spread across the board. It was like 37% APAC, 39% Europe, and then 24% Americas, which is interesting. Usually with most of these threats, we see at least one country kind of pull ahead, but this one was pretty even. Another office malware, W37 or 97M download, which is another generic signature for detecting certain strains of malware, was, as with previous quarters, 98% in the Americas. So very heavily favored towards a single region. And that kind of makes sense with that, because with office-based threats, maybe they're only focusing on like English character sets.
They have to pick
sets.
A certain language, whether it be, you know, I don't know, British, German, or U.S. English.
Yep. So interesting stuff there. Anything else you wanted to cover before we move on to the network attacks?
No, I think if you're interested in more, there's other details in the report. You should definitely check them out.
Yep. So network attacks, back to the super exciting high-level stats. 851,000 hits for network attacks in the last quarter, which is a 17.5% decrease from quarter two.
I think we could just summarize this by way down.
Yeah.
Since last quarter, when they really dropped, it is down even more.
Yeah, last quarter was a 90% decrease from quarter one. We lost like 10 million hits or so, which is an interesting trend that for this year seems to be really going down. We looked into it and it seemed like a few individual signatures are getting less hits.
Yeah.
So whether that be some changes we made to them are making them less prone to false positives, or if people are just attacking them less.
Although, if I remember right, I mean, we looked at two of the signatures responsible for the high hits in Q1 and before, and they looked semi-legit, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. So big drops. It'll be interesting to see if it moves back up with malware in quarter four. Yeah. Or if this is our new norm of just lower network attacks.
For IPS, I always suspect the volume can sometimes be this automated botnet scanning, meaning one of the common payloads to a Trojan or botnet is just to start scanning random internet addresses and launch basic exploits against open ports, whether or not you know if they'll succeed or not. And it, this could be something as simple as if authorities downed a bot. I'm trying to remember the name, but I do know that one big botnet was taken down a while ago. So it could be anything from a botnet going down. It could also even be companies penetration testing or vulnerability assessment cycles. If you're not doing as much of that, that could, those, by the way, would equally be caught by IPS in the same way that normal attacks are.
Yeah. A bit of a deep cut on the high level stats. Normally, our top two attacks out of the top 10 account for just about half of all of our total network attack hits. And that's down to just 20%. So the top two threats are only 20% of all of our threats.
And those two, by the way, were web-based, right?
Yep.
So in general, the level of web-based threats went down a little.
So there's a bigger spread when it comes to which hits are accounting for the highest volume in the top 10, which is another interesting trend. When it comes to individual hits, a lot of the stuff we've seen previously, there were three new attacks this quarter that we hadn't seen previously. I guess I shouldn't say they're new attacks. They're old attacks.
Yeah, they're actually very old attacks.
Yeah. One of them.
I would say the most important one is probably Adobe Flash / Air vulnerability. Yep. I won't bore you guys with the CVE, but basically you can get an Adobe file that has embedded MP3 with especially crafted metadata, specifically the ID3 tag. And that could cause attacker to execute code on your system. This is a four-year-old Adobe vulnerability, so if you keep anything even a little up to date, you should be fine. But the reason I think this is most important is I do see a lot of Adobe Flash vulnerabilities. I suspect this is one of those WebKit exploits that, you know, they keep it in their exploit library forever because there's always somebody that has an old version of Flash.
Flash is on the way out, though. I know most browsers are killing support for the plugin support.
You know, that was true, but didn't Windows 10 bring it back? For the longest time, you know, YouTube doesn't use it anymore. That's at least 5 years old. So Flash should be going away. But I thought that Microsoft actually has it embedded in Windows 10 now, which is why they have to do updates for Flash every time Adobe updates
Flash
now.
Like browser-wise in Firefox, it was actually a pain for me to try and re-enable Flash support.
Chrome specifically, even if you install Flash, so you have the plugin, Chrome won't let a site run unless you click the
allow this little button
to let Flash run at the top.
Yep.
So yes, to me, I feel like you should go away from Flash, but there's still pockets of people that use it.
And long story short, there are, it seems, weekly patches for Flash for 0 days and vulnerabilities found. So if you've been at least paying
attention. Or more specifically, Patch Tuesday, Microsoft Patch Tuesday is when Adobe does stuff too. So if you just do Patch Tuesday with Adobe and Microsoft, you should be good. Auto update.
Exactly. New threat number two that we detected was actually a really old one, a vulnerability in Sun Java Web Server from 2010, which I think has to be just another exploit kit edition that's automatically scanning
this
for.
This could even be a penetrate, you know, a vulnerability assessment tool, because this is just a classic exploit you would scan against your network.
Exactly. And the last one was Shellshock, a vulnerability you might have heard from 2014.
Probably newer than some of them, although it still is old, right?
Yep. So cool seeing new threats in there. Changes it up. I know in previous quarters we've had instances where there were no new threats in the top 10 list.
I will say, by the way, the number one threat, and one that we did put in the executive summary of the report, but we don't talk much about in the body, is the number one IPS hit this quarter was cross-site scripting. It's a signature to generically catch certain types of cross-site scripting. So I thought that was rather interesting. Cross-site scripting, of course, is if you have a vulnerable web application, someone might be able to either, depending on where it is in your application, do something called a stored cross-site scripting attack, where they literally put something in your database that when users go to a certain page on your website, it's always going to execute whatever bad code they want, which could be, you know, redirecting people to an evil website, or could be stealing your visitors' cookies to log in.
Or even loading a cryptojacker.
Oh, exactly, loading a cryptojacker. And there's even things like, what is it called, the framework. The cross-site browser exploitation something framework, where you can even get full code execution on web servers through cross-site scripting. Or it could be a reflective attack, which is still a vulnerability in your web application, but it does require your users to actually click a link in order for it to work, and it only works one time.
And cross-site scripting, I mean, in general, has been known for quite some time, but the fact is web developers are not infallible, and there are times where they will make a mistake.
I have a friend of mine who was a web developer. When I brought up how bad cross-site scripting was once, he said, "Oh, that's so 2008." But it's not. It's not gone. There's still many web applications out there that suffer from this very basic issue. The way I always put it is, if you see cross-site scripting demos, you know, we tend to show the easy and most obvious place to inject code, like in login parameters or in basic URL parameters. There's much deeper mechanisms and websites that can also suffer from cross-site scripting, but they're harder to do without a browser proxy like Burp. But they still exist. So this isn't 2008. This is still one of the number one web vulnerabilities out there.
Sometime over this last year, I read an article from a researcher who was doing vulnerability analysis of, I can't remember which web application it was. But he set up a way to detect cross-site scripting vulnerabilities where he had a web server and a bit of code. And anytime that code executed, it pinged his web server. So he knew there was an issue. And he was testing this website. He thought he found one. He injected it into it, and then nothing until like 2 months later, when he submitted a ticket to that same website for some issue. And then the support, when they pulled up his account info, they triggered it on their own customer support portal.
Yeah,
which was interesting.
There's sometimes obscure ones that aren't triggered until logs. Like I've seen ones where like it could be a network appliance that proxies traffic, where you could send a request to a web server. It's not going to actually trigger anything immediately, but the way it's logged, when you go to that web-based management system to look at the log, then it causes a cross-site scripting attack in your network appliance's web UI. So
exactly,
there's lots of crafty ways to trigger them that I don't think devs are used to yet.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to regional stats for network attacks, Europe had 69% of all of our total hits, or 63% rather, which is pretty
typical.
High.
EMEA is usually the one that leads here.
Americas were at 29%, and APAC was all the way down at 8.7%, which means they're only going to safe websites, right?
And oh, sure.
We're the ones going to all the pirated content. In terms of individual
hits.
What
are you talking about? Pirate sites are safe, right? There's nothing that could go wrong visiting the pirate site.
Yarr. That vulnerability in the Sun Java web server that was new, 98.6% of all detections for it were based out of Europe, and APAC had zero hits total. Shellshock, 99.9% of them were hitting Europe. So it seems like a lot of these...
Very regional.
Yeah, very, very regional, which in some of them, it's not necessarily the servers hosted in Europe, but the browsing patterns of our customers that have these appliances protecting them are based in Europe, and they're going to these sites that only Europeans go to, I suppose.
Yep.
That was it. What takeaways do we have for this? I just keep your software updated and your browsers updated.
Yeah, if you want a little more deep tips, nowadays, if there's any software that allows automatic updates, whether it be operating systems like Apple or Windows, whether it be things like Adobe, which always allows like fully automated, I don't mean download and say yes, I mean just update whenever you can. For desktop clients, meaning your normal employees, I actually encourage it. Now, of course, there might be a little pain. The reason in the past you don't do automated updates and the reason I don't recommend it for production servers is because patches can have flaws and there's old stories of Windows Update messing stuff up. Mm-hmm. But I think for the average desktop user, the risk is much lower. The only other risk is that they might have to reboot, but usually updates aren't going to force you to reboot. They'll do a pop-up telling you when it's ready so that you don't lose work. But I just say for clients, they're probably at the most risk of these web exploits in the first place. So force those systems to automatically update immediately. Don't wait for the test and deploy process unless you have some really important reason why.
I can't even think of any time in the last few years that we've had a blue screen Monday from Windows.
Not on clients, yeah. And I on my personal home network, they all auto update. I do have a server, and the advice is a little different there. If it's an important productive server, you should test those updates still. Mm-hmm. But other than that, just let your software do it for you.
Yep. Make sure your data is backed up just in case, of course.
Yeah.
Backups are always important.
But hopefully they're doing that because they learned from ransomware in 2013 and beyond.
Hopefully. But I mean, something tells
that's
me
that's why ransomware is not an issue anymore, right? Because everyone backs up.
We fixed the issue. There is no more ransomware. Just ask Atlanta. Next section in our report was our top security incident, which this quarter we talked about.
This is always hard because there's rarely ever security incidents any quarter, right?
Yeah, because we solved all the stuff and no one gets hacked
businesses
anymore.
They're breach proof, I'm sure.
Except for Facebook, apparently.
Oh, wait, is that the subject of today's top security incident?
Yep, and I know we've talked about the 50 million account Facebook breach on a previous podcast episode, so I won't dive too much into it, but...
But when they're down, kick them.
Exactly. Yes. As someone who has relatively recently deleted their Facebook, I am going to sit on my high horse and kick them while they're down.
By the way, I'll give you your high horse. Apparently, I think it's The Verge recently released an article about Facebook's morale problem getting worse, where they list all the different ways Facebook's screwing up. So,
yikes.
I can't get rid of it yet, but I won't give you too much crap. Although you still probably have Twitter and Instagram and... Name the other social networks.
I suppose I do. So Facebook, just at a high level, we talked about they had an incident where they had 50 million accounts compromised by an attacker exploiting really a chain of vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and we did talk about the chain, I think, in one of our podcasts a bit.
Yep. Check it out in the report. I go through it in fairly detail of like the steps the attacker had to go through. It involved a feature called the View As feature, where you could see how your profile looked in the context of another user. So if you want to make sure like your party pictures are blocked from your mom, you can view your account as your mom and she cannot see your party pictures.
Why would I ever want to block things from my mom? Now my frenemies, on the other hand.
Exactly. Or if you like are friends with your boss on Facebook for some weird reason.
What? Now I'm going to have to figure out how to reverse the view as fix. See what Mark is thinking.
I actually don't know if they've returned it, but as part of their response to this attack, they actually completely removed the view as feature.
I didn't know if they did that or just removed the happy birthday video part of it.
They disabled view as entirely as they gave it a thorough security scrubbing. But the attacker is able to exploit this feature in order to generate authentication tokens. So a session token, like they had logged in as someone, as the context of the view as. So if I viewed my profile as, say, Corey, if we were friends, I could generate a token that says I am now Corey, which means I could access his account and then do the exact same thing for all of your friends. And the attacker automated this and managed to hit 50 million accounts.
And by the way, you should, if you didn't hear our podcast about it, you should still read Mark's section. I think to me, the biggest takeaway or the biggest learning, it's not really something you can do, but I think what this list of three issues coming together really shows you is how seemingly minor issues can add up. There's a lot of cases where, it's especially the vendors sometimes pushing back against security researchers when a researcher finds something and the vendor's like, well, this is not that big a deal because of blah, blah, blah. But sometimes you don't realize how things work together. So seeing how three separate issues that on their own may not have been a huge deal could suddenly turn into such a critical issue, I think that was the most fascinating part about that particular
news. In this case, it was literally the ability to post a happy birthday video in what should have been a read-only interface is what led to this entire breach.
Yeah.
Something seemingly innocuous that just...
And by the way, each of the things that had to happen for it to work by themselves may not have really given away too much information. It's them working all together that really led to the big problem.
Yep. And we have a few other takeaways in the report. One other one I want to highlight right now is... technically, this token could have been used to access any third-party linked accounts you had with Facebook. So any apps where you sign in with your Facebook account.
No one does that. No one orders lunch at work and just clicks to log in with Facebook to save some time, right?
Exactly. Now, Facebook does say they don't see any evidence of this, and I mean, there's no evidence to the contrary, but it does show a weakness in the convenience versus security approach to some of these account linkings. It's really convenient to just have one single account that you can then use to access other
log
services.
Log into Instagram, log into Spotify, or whatever.
But if it gets compromised, then all of those other services could potentially be compromised. So you need to have a conscious decision of, do you want to link them for convenience, or do you? Does this particular service require a little more security?
I'll give an example. I'm sure WordPress, when you first sign up, has the option to use your Facebook login, and WordPress can be vulnerable. So do you really want, if someone hacks your silly WordPress blog, do you really want them to have access to your whole Facebook?
Whose blog are you calling silly?
Simplicity.com. I'm kidding.
I only post on super serious blogs.
But my WordPress blog is all about finding shiny new stones on the beach. So
really?
I'm sure it's fascinating.
Could have sworn it was My Little Pony.
Oh, no. Don't put that on me like other people at work have.
If you have not seen Corey's desk at work, the sheer volume of My Little Ponies on it is astounding.
Although my favorite is still the Squatty Potty Unicorn.
That one's pretty good, too. Back on topic.
What? I thought this was our topic, right? This is Pop Culture Hour with Mark and Corey.
Yes. Man, is that our next section in the quarterly security report? No, it's actually our threat research section. And this quarter...
What? We do work here at WatchGuard?
Sometimes. only on Thursdays. For our research section for this quarter, we decided to audit the top 100,000 and in one case, top million websites out there on the internet to check how their security is in a few different areas. We chose the top 100,000 for most of our tests because the number of page views is highly concentrated towards the top 100,000, even more specifically the top 10,000. To give you an example, the website ranked number one, 42.5 billion views per month. Whereas...
I wonder what site that is.
Yeah. Ranked 10,000 is only 4.6 million. And rank 100,000 is less than 300,000. So it goes up by orders of magnitude towards the most popular websites.
By the way, there's a beautiful infographic in our report that will illustrate just this thing.
It is a very, very pretty line graph, yes.
Amazing folks with their graphical capabilities.
Exactly. So one of the tests we ran this last quarter was simply testing HTTPS, so SSL and TLS support for websites. Do they support encryption? And how secure is the encryption that they support?
And by the way, this wasn't just the average test. I think the team actually wrote a script where we weren't just testing the highest level, but it was literally trying to create a connection with every variant to see exactly which ones it supported both ways.
Yeah, it's actually
a
bit of a chore to figure out exactly which protocols a website supports, because the way the negotiation works when you set up encryption for your web connection is your client advertises a number of different protocols that it supports, so maybe TLS 1, 2, and 3, and then the server picks the highest one and negotiates that. So in order to test if the server supports the weaker protocols, you have to send a request for just that weaker protocol and give a thumbs up or thumbs down if it actually successfully negotiates.
Yep.
At a high level, only 79,000 of the top 100,000 websites successfully negotiated some form of SSL or TLS, so 79% or so.
Which means 20.9% are not encrypted at all.
Yep.
May not be a bad thing. It's hard to say. Depends what they do.
But the internet is moving towards encrypting everything.
It may be tough with browsers like Chrome pushing it to be that site that doesn't support it anymore, because your site's going to get called not secure. In fact, it is today by Chrome called not secure.
Yep. It started out with, if your site hosted like a login form and it wasn't using HTTPS, it would be labeled as not secure. And they're moving towards just in general, if you are not encrypting your website, it's going to be labeled as not secure in the browser bar instead of just that neutral that it used to be with a green padlock if it was encrypted. Of those 79,000 sites that did negotiate some form of encryption, 6.8% of them still supported SSL v2 and SSL v3, which are, at this point, very old and heavily deprecated protocols.
By the way, I think security people just call them dead. You should not be using them. People can man-in-the-middle SSL v2 almost trivially.
Yeah. SSL v3 had a really big vulnerability disclosed, must have been 3-4 years ago now, called Poodle was its acronym. Where it used the padding in the encryption algorithms in
Poodle's
order to...
Poodle's not an acronym, it's a dog.
Exactly. In order to decrypt bytes of the connection.
By the way, bonus points if you can actually remember what Poodle acronym stood for.
Padding on Oracle downgrade legacy encryption.
That is probably right. Good
Something
job.
Like that. Woo-hoo.
It was definitely an Oracle attack.
Yeah. More seriously, though, with SSL v2, it has a vulnerability called Drown, where if a server simply supports SSL v2, you don't even have to force the client you're trying to attack to downgrade to it. Even if they're using a TLS encrypted connection, you can capture that traffic and then use the server to decrypt that traffic because it supports SSL v2. Whereas Poodle, you had to be in the middle of that connection you're trying to attack and force the client to downgrade into SSL v3. So, I mean, while SSL v2 is obviously even less secure, both are bad. Should not be enabled, but still 7% of websites in the 79% or 79K that had encryption were using this. We list, I think, a dozen or so of the actual websites in the report.
Yep.
Mass Lottery was one of them. So the Massachusetts State Lottery website, which luckily didn't appear to have any input forms that might take sensitive information that absolutely should be encrypted. But it's still I would imagine, a decently popular website in the state of Massachusetts that, let's say if you're visiting it from a coffee shop, if it doesn't have encryption, someone could inject a crypto miner into that connection quite easily. Other ones on there was a Japanese magazine and shopping website. There was a data analytics company website based out of India, a website to buy vehicle parts in Russia. Those are just a few. There were a few more we listed there, and there were really, what, like 1,000 or so?
And even for the state lottery site, like you say, where there, I think the one thing that they did have was they told visitors where to send payments.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't attack the visitors, but if you can man in the middle that, you can give the visitors a false place to send payments and kind of steal payments
yep.
from the Massachusetts State Lottery.
Yep.
And one, by the way, one thing is we're actually kind of treating these sites that have, as I mentioned, 20.9% of sites didn't have any encryption, but we actually think that the 6.8% that is using SSL v2 or v3 might even be worse. And the reason is yes, it's bad that a site doesn't have encryption, but if you know it's not encrypted because you see it and it doesn't ask for any personal information, you could argue who gives a crap. But
don't tell Troy Hunt that.
Exactly. Yes. I by the way, I'm for encrypting all of the web, so I don't want that to be an excuse for people not to go to encryption. But on the flip side, if a site shows you that green or now normal lock, that means it's secure to the average user. And unfortunately, SSL v2 and SSL v3 connections, when you're just going to a site and you're not paying attention to the certificate and information you can get from your browser, that lock seems just as secure on a SSL v2 site as it does on a TLS 1.3 site. So our argument is the ones that actually can downgrade or only use these really outdated SSL encryption protocols are almost worse because they give a very big false sense of security to visitors.
And I suppose the silver lining in this is that I'm pretty sure that the main browsers like Firefox and Chrome by now have SSL v2 and 3 disabled by default. So you'd have to go out of your way in order to re-enable support for them.
That's one key thing, by the way. You might have mentioned this. When we do the 6.8%, it doesn't. There were a few. I think there's something like 5 sites that only supported SSL v2, which is horrible. But the ones that from the 6.8%, they actually did support higher ciphers. The reason that's sometimes not good enough, even if your browser has a higher cipher as an attacker, by, you know, you mentioned it's the client side that advertises what they're capable of doing. Mm-hmm. So a downgrade attack is trivial. The attacker just says that, you know, he'll adjust his web packets to say, I can only support v2. And even if your website supports better encryption protocols, it's going to go down to v2.
Now, how about when it comes to good support of encryption? When it comes to TLS 1.3, which was only just approved in March of this year, 22% of all the websites we tested supported TLS 1.3, which is good. There was, what, 2 websites that
only supported? Yeah, I thought it was funny that there's a couple that only supported 1.3. And if I remember right, I don't have the sites in front of me, but one of them seemed to be related to, let's say, maybe video piracy. And it's kind of funny that perhaps underground site has better security than the average site out there.
Yep.
You could understand maybe why they would do that, though, you know, if they're blocking their site by a login and don't want authorities monitoring them.
Exactly. Other tests we did, you probably have heard on past episodes of the podcast that Symantec certificates were being removed from the trusted store on Google Chrome and Mozilla Firefox browsers in October. And so as part of our tests, we went to go see which websites were still using Symantec signed certificates. I think we tested on September 9th, and then we tested again on D-Day. So October 16th, when Google Chrome 70 was released, that removed support. On September 9th, there was 2,500 or so of the top 1 million websites still used a Symantec signed certificate. And when it came to D-Day, that number was down to 1,633, which is good. It means that 900 or so fixed their issue, but there was still a decent number of sites that were using a cert that would now show as untrusted.
And I think we show a list of some of those URLs too, and some of them are more surprising than others.
Yeah, there was a couple like computer hardware manufacturers on there. I think like MSI and EVGA's websites were on there. UFC Fighting was on there. Porsche was on it. And we named and shamed a few more as well of the ones that on the date that Chrome 16 was released or Chrome 70 was released were still using this now untrusted certificate. Our main takeaways for this section were we went and tried to grade very subjectively, the security ratings for these, the internet, I suppose. And obviously websites that still support SSL v2 and 3, which should have been removed quite some time ago, get a very poor grade. But I mean, on the whole, I feel like the internet did pretty okay.
I think they did okay. I think we gave them a good grade for the semantic thing because it was just such a low percentage of the top 100. So
something.
We did like B. Now, on the flip side, only 6.8% of the top 100,000 did SSL V2 and 3. But I think we kind of more subjectively felt that the sites that are doing that, it's such a bad thing that we kind of gave them a D as a whole. That doesn't mean the sites that are doing well are RD, but we really think even those 5,500 some sites still using the bad protocols really need to up their game quickly.
Yeah, step up your game, internet. Anything else you wanted to add before we move on to our just main conclusions and head on out of here?
I think that's it.
Cool. You want to take the first one?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we've covered this, so we'll just go really quick. I think in this report, even though we didn't spend much time in the body of it, Mimikatz was still the number one threat. Multi-factor authentication has been a common theme in our report because really, you know, the easiest way for a hacker to breach your network is I don't want to have to find any technical flaws or trick your users. If I can just steal a user's password, all your base are belong to me. So.
Nerd.
Give me one privileged user and I'm good to go. And the way to combat that is multi-factor authentication. If you haven't deployed it in your infrastructure, you should. Even if you're a small business that doesn't think you can afford multi-factor authentication, look into products like ours, Authpoint, because it's inexpensive, it's mobile phone based, but in a very secure way.
Yep. Another takeaway, which we also highlighted, was Mac computers are no longer invulnerable to malware. Not that they ever were, but we foresee attackers continuing to push towards making more malware that hits Macs. The scareware we saw today isn't going to be the last Mac threat we see in the top 10 list in the years.
Frankly, it's not even the scariest. We have seen, you know, through the community, real Trojans on Macs before.
Yep. So that means you really do need to start looking at endpoint protection for your Macs to go on top of what you have with Gatekeeper, and then also make sure that they are protected to the same extent as your Windows machines on your home and corporate networks too, with network-based appliance detection too.
By the way, while you know, we're part of WatchGuard, so often we talk about WatchGuard products, and I normally don't like to advertise other people's stuff, you know, buzz marketing, as John Hodgman would call it. But I do say I'm a Mac user, and I've been using security suites on both the anti-malware and a special firewall, and I really highly recommend a program called Little Snitch. It's very specifically a host-based...
I'm sorry, Little what?
Little Snitch.
Okay.
It's snitching on the IT department trying to exfiltrate data from my laptop because I see every single connection. Anyways, Little Switch is a firewall, but it's a very specialized host-based firewall. And host-based firewalls are a little different than network in that you can actually make rules for every single policy, or I'm sorry, every single process. So when I allow web traffic, it's not just by allowing all of port 80. It's, do I allow web traffic from Chrome? Yes. Do I allow web traffic from TextEdit? Well, maybe not, right? Why the heck is TextEdit trying to go to the web? So Little Snitch will literally, every time there's in or out network traffic, it will pop up and ask you to create a temporary or forever rule for it. And it's based on every single process. And I think it's a great way to control the networking communications from your computer. Because if you get infected by malware, you know, sometimes it's going to be this weird process trying to make different network connections. You'll be able to see them happen and block them.
Does take a bit of setup time, though?
It's actually very easy to install, but the first 2 weeks, you're going to have to reply to a lot of messages. Now, you're essentially training it, so hopefully you're allowing some products forever. So if people ever see me do presentations, you're going to see pop-ups once in a while. If I go to a hotel, suddenly I'll get boot P connections to my laptop. But to me, you know, after that first two-week training period, it's much less hands-on. And I actually personally think it's well worth the hands-on.
Awesome. Another takeaway, which comes from our top incident section, was really training your users on how to best practices when it revolves around social media. So one of the takeaways we didn't hit in that section specifically was, regardless of the privacy settings on your accounts, you should really consider anything you post on the internet as public, whether
yes.
it be a data leak, or in the context of Facebook, at least within their guidelines leak of data to a third party, eventually it's probably going to get out there. So make sure you're not posting anything that can A, be used to compromise other accounts, like security question answers, but also just be very careful about what you click, what you post, and who you connect with, because it could be used to attack you.
Don't post anything you're not comfortable with your grandma seeing.
Exactly. And that's why I'm not on Facebook.
I love that tip of yours in your section, by the way. I also say it's a good time to go back and look at privacy settings. Now, of course, the social network problem has gotten so bad that now the privacy settings themselves are extremely complex because mm-hmm. there's so many of them. But it's really worth getting familiar with those privacy settings because they can often save you from some of these social networking leaks.
You have any last takeaways before we bounce?
I think that's probably good. They heard a lot of the other takeaways. You know, we have tons of services on our device, which is why we drive this report. We have the best anti-malware detection with three of them. So if you are a Firebox owner, make sure you have those set up properly. But other than that, keep staying vigilant.
And check out the report to read the rest of the goodies that we kind of glossed over. And again, if you are a WatchGuard customer, please help us out with our threat intelligence feed by going into the global general settings for your Firebox and checking that send device feedback to WatchGuard checkbox. It does help a ton, and it gives us a more accurate picture of what's out there on the interwebs.
And by the way, ultimately, it drives our product strategy and even some of our default configuration, so it will help secure you in the future.
Yep. And with that, check out the report, and thank you again for listening. Thanks for listening, everyone. We are actually off next week for the holidays. Corey decided that he's finally allowed to leave the office.
Yay!
And then we will have a...
I mean, boo!
Trust me, it's great for all of us. Then we'll have a... Oh, please don't fire me. A special best of episode where we pick our favorite hits from our various podcasts we've done throughout this last year and mash them together into one big one to roll out the end of the year.
And silver lining, Mark's hosting that one alone, so you'll only have to hear me in segments. And I assume best of, it's going to be all Mark and not me, right?
Exactly. We'll find some way to edit you out of it entirely.
Sounds like a reason to listen in.
Yeah. Thanks again for listening. If you have any suggestions for future episode topics or questions on this week's, please hit us up on Twitter. I'm at XORRO_. Corey's at SecAdept. Or you can get the both of us with one stone at #the443podcast. You can also get your daily dose of security news and insights at secplicity.org. Thanks for listening, and see you in a couple of weeks.